I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It's not every day you look at the director of Pinocchio and you say, so can kids watch this? But that's a fair question for Guillermo del Toro, who won the Oscar for his version of Pinocchio just the other week. He'll tell you why Pinocchio he thinks is a darker, more grown-up story, and why he chose to include fascism in his version. That's coming up. Plus, the musician Jeremy Dutcher has spent most of his career talking about language, specifically about his family's language, Wolastoqe, a language that was in danger of going extinct. But now Jeremy and his mother have teamed up to start a school to make sure the language is not just preserved, but spoken. And they'll be here to tell you all about that. I'm Tom Power. You were listening to Q. So, Guillermo del Toro won the Oscar a few weeks ago for Best Animated Feature for his version of Pinocchio that's out now on Netflix. Let's listen to a little bit of his acceptance speech.
Animation is cinema. Animation is not a genre. And animation is ready to be taken to the next step. Thank you.
I mean, you can tell the passion that Guillermo del Toro has for film, not just as like an entertaining medium, but as a way to make us think differently about the world around us. You might know Guillermo del Toro from his Oscar-winning films like Pan's Labyrinth or The Shape of Water. A few years ago, Guillermo came into the studio and we talked to him. I mean, this is before the conversation you're about to hear. And one of the things we found ourselves talking about a lot was Frankenstein, which was a really big influence on him as a kid, because he realized early on that Frankenstein's monster is not the monster. The monster is us. The monster is society and the way we treated Frankenstein's monster. And that leads to, I think, Pinocchio. Pinocchio, you know the story, it's a wooden puppet who gains sentience like some kind of terrifying AI, and his nose grows every time he tells a lie and he wants to become a real boy. That's the story, right? But Guillermo uses the story to talk broadly about society's acceptance of authority. At one point in this conversation, he talks about Pinocchio as sort of a Christ-like figure. So Pinocchio is out on Netflix now. Jury's out whether you should let the kids watch it by themselves. Here's my conversation with Guillermo del Toro.
How are you?
Very good, man.
Congratulations on this.
Well, thank you.
It's great.
Thank you. It's a whole team thanks you. Producers, animators, two directors, Mark Gustafson and I, we all thank you, man.
Well, you're welcome. Tell them all you're welcome.
You are all welcome. You hear? No, it was such a, I mean, this is like building the pyramids. You have hundreds of people carrying stones for years,
A
1,000 days of shoot.
A
1,000 days of shoot.
Why Pinocchio? What did Pinocchio mean to you growing up?
It was either the second or the third film I saw with my mother. And it was the first time in that long cinephile life of seven-year-old Guillermo where I felt somebody understood how dark it felt to be a child.
Father! What you crying for?
Because you're dead, Pinocchio.
And I was like, yeah, this is not a happy cartoon on TV. This is somebody gets it. And I still have this feeling with Disney. You know, I think Disney had a huge reservoir of darkness to command the light also, you know? And I think narratively, his films are full of this ingenuity and this pain. So I felt it all. It was the first Disney movie I saw, and it hit me really the hardest.
There is something about that. Like, I remember being a kid and my dad taking me to see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, yeah.
And leaving because I was too scared.
Yes.
The idea of that happening to a kid's cartoon.
We were with Quentin Tarantino about 4 weeks ago, and he said, in all seriousness, he said, the scariest, goriest movie, most violent movie I ever saw was Bambi.
Yeah.
He said, I had to leave the theater. I was so scared, so terrified. And it's the first time you say, you mean my mom can die?
Yeah.
And my dad is going to be this shadowy figure saying, come with me, son. It's like mythical.
Mother!
Your mother can't be with you anymore. Come, my son.
And I think that proportion of Disney people, when people say Disney-fied, I go, yeah, pray tell me more, because this or that don't correspond to the idea I have of Disney.
So it's such a dark experience you have watching this film when you're a kid. But then, so then what? Like you.
Then I identify with Pinocchio very much.
As I did
with Frankenstein's creature, because I feel that they are both about a father just giving birth to a son, sort of in a haphazard manner, and sending the kid into what is an experiential, almost initiatic journey through life to figure it out without any real assistance. And I felt like that as a kid. I felt like the truths and lies that the adults were praying that I understood were all really hollow. And life was telling me a bunch of things that were different. So I love that aspect of it. And they are related in a way. You know, they are both creatures that don't quite belong in the natural world. And I felt like that as a kid. And I had a really sense of otherness. Like I didn't conform to the idea that people had of a young boy, healthy, playing football. I was like this rail thin. Can you imagine that? Rail thin, pale, quiet kid that buttoned all his buttons in the shirt, that never spoke, looked around, really spooked, you know? So I identified with that. I didn't like at all. It stuck in my craw, the idea of obedience and being something you're not in order to be accepted. So those two things are completely counter in our Pinocchio.
There's another connection between Frankenstein and your Pinocchio that I want to get to in just a second that I think we found. But first, I think it's helpful to set up for people who haven't seen it that it's set up. Your Pinocchio happens during
between World War I and World War II.
So the rise of fascism
and
Mussolini.
Which all happens, by the way, on the periphery or off screen.
Yeah.
And this is very important because I did the same in Devil's Backbone. I refuse, if I can avoid it, I refuse to have a proper war scene because then that upends the entire balance.
Yeah.
I need to keep it sort of off screen, but the dynamics of the sort of ghostly, corrosive parental power that fascism exerts over certain souls, it needs to be there. And it's in the story of the fascist officer Podesta and his son.
You follow my orders, learn to obey, and you will be the perfect soldier.
But my papa?
You'll return home a hero. Any father would be proud of such a son.
But what? Why? Why did you want to bring Mussolini and fascism into the story at all?
Because it's another paternal story. I mean, it's really the whole movie, including Jesus and God, is about fathers and sons. Oh, Pinocchio is sort of a surrogate, imperfect messiah, resurrecting and dying for those that he loves. I think that all these wires are crossed in my head and they all make sense in the way they inform each other. If I'm going to make a movie about disobedience being a virtue, what better place to set it than in an invisible sort of string world where everybody obeys except the puppet? There are many, many, many reasons. And if you think about a note being hit in a piano, these elements, death, life, how brief it is, fascism, the imperfect fathers and imperfect sons, they all hit the pedal on the note to make it a little more resonant with what I think it should sound like.
But I heard that you always knew that you wanted Mussolini to be like the fascism of Mussolini to be part of Pinocchio. Like you've known that whenever you, that when you were a kid, you were like, someday I'm going to make a Pinocchio.
Since my 20s. Yeah. Since my 20s. And as a kid, I knew I wanted disobedience. I knew I wanted disobedience and I knew I wanted him to sort of be unruly. But I didn't, you know, until my 20s when I was thinking, well, it would be great to do that. And then part of that, funny enough, ended up in Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah.
Or Devil's Backbone.
Yeah.
And now it's like this movie belongs with those two in a very organic way.
The let's go back to something you were saying just then, that the, and this is, I don't know if I fully remember my experience watching Pinocchio mm-hmm. when I was a kid, mm-hmm. but I have some recollection of it. And what I don't think happened in that, which I think happens in yours, is what you said earlier, that Pinocchio comes out and you're sort of expecting this sweet, lovable puppet, but he's disobeying right from the very, very beginning.
Yes,
you know, his father tells him, Geppetto tells him not to go to church. And he says, I'm going to church no matter what, you know, like his father tells him to stay here. Mm-hmm. He's going to, you know, he's disobeying the idea that the puppet is the person who is.
Has a will.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, talk to me about that.
Well, the idea, we wanted Geppetto to be really, really full of edges. He's a drunk. He's not that super smart.
No.
He's a father that is very concerned with the way everybody looks at him.
Yeah.
And how Pinocchio makes him look.
He lost a child.
Yeah, he's lost a child, but he has fantasized that memory. He has sort of made him a perfect son.
Yeah.
He is full of things that are baggage for him to be a good father or a real father. And I thought this was the more interesting version. Instead of Pinocchio learning to be a real boy, which is nonsense.
Yeah.
Every boy is a real boy. Every kid is a real kid. Parents have a hard time becoming a real parent. And that was the story I wanted to pursue. And at the same time, that has to be tied with a really imperfect Pinocchio. When he's born, we wanted to make the scene almost feel like Frankenstein's lab, really full of thunder and lightning and hammers and nails and branches being broken, really traumatology of the birth, you know? And then arrived to the birth of Pinocchio in the hangover. And Geppetto is completely unprepared.
Good morning, Papa!
What is this? What kind of sorcery?
You wanted me to live. You asked for me to live.
Who are you?
My name is Pinocchio. I'm your son.
You're not my son.
And this puppet doesn't control his body, and he looks like a spider.
Yeah.
He looks really weird, and he is a bit much.
Yeah.
He's breaking everything. He's asking all the questions. He will not obey. He crushes the cricket. He bursts into church. It's really, they are really far apart from coming together. That's the ideal, dramatically, that's the ideal way to start a movie.
Yeah.
You know, but it also informs the theme. It's a story about imperfect fathers and imperfect sons.
Isn't it also a story about, like, mortality? Like, I was watching this and I was thinking about it because, so in this story, I don't think this is giving anything away. In the story, Pinocchio dies a number of
several
times. Yeah. And he comes back to life. And there's a couple of scenes where, I mean, there's one where they say something like, you know, you are never going to die. Mm-hmm.
You will die many, many times.
Yeah.
But they will not be real death.
And you said, and she says that it's the brevity of life that makes it special. The idea that life is short.
The one thing that makes human life precious and meaningful, you see, is how brief it is.
Oh.
I didn't expect to have an existential crisis watching Pinocchio, but I kind of did. And I was curious for you, like, back to what you were talking about, you had a preoccupation when you were a kid with authority and with conformity.
Yeah.
Did you have a preoccupation with death or with afterlife?
I think this movie solves a lot of issues for me. I was very worried about death, but there's a reason the maternal figure in this film is death. And as the real maternal figure with Pinocchio, life is sort of happy-go-lucky, giving life away, but without a plan. Death is very deliberately motherly and takes Pinocchio step by step into understanding what it is to be a real boy, what it is to be human, and she guides him all the way to him making the decision. I will go back and save my papa. You know, it's really moving for me because death, as I aged and I lost my father and then I lost my mother, I really feel that it makes you really humble in the sense that, oh, it's coming. And it actually is beautiful that I'm going to end. It's beautiful because if something doesn't end, it never be gone, period. And I was saying is the metronome of life and death in the universe that marks our existence. And it never stops for anyone. That's beautiful. You are not that special. And therefore, while you're here, it's a very special time. Because this is all you're going to get. One ride, one time, that's it. So I find it very Mexican. It may be a little alien, but Mexico, we are full throttle because we know where we're heading, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still scary to me.
No.
You know what I mean? Because I remember, they're both scary because I grew up Catholic. I know you did too. Mm-hmm. And I remember being promised eternal life. And then I remember one day going like, eternal life also sounds terrifying.
Yes. Oh, no. Listen, look at my first movie, Kronos. A Geppetto-like figure with a granddaughter is facing eternity and chooses to destroy the machine that gives him eternity, to die. And the final scene is very much like the final scene of Pinocchio, is this figure dying in bed with a ray of light, exactly like Pinocchio, and the granddaughter by his side, finally at peace. Because the desirable thing in a vampire story is to end.
Yeah.
You know, I've been thinking about death since I was 7 years old. And I never stopped. And I think I finally understood one thing. It's actually really, really beautiful that we end. And it makes it great. Makes it this life beautiful.
But didn't you see a ghost?
Yeah.
And I'm not being silly.
Yeah,
here.
But I don't know what is past.
What's that story that you did? You saw a ghost when you were 12?
I heard.
You heard?
I've heard two times I've heard ghosts. Whether they are illusions or not, when I was very young, about 12 years old, I heard the ghost of what I believe was my uncle breathing around me and moving around me. And it could have been a delusion, 100%. I'm not saying it was, but I heard it. And I heard it again because I always ask for the haunted room in hotels.
Really?
And I'm always disappointed. You know,
you go to a hotel and you go, give me the haunted room?
I know what hotels are haunted in theory, and I've gone through most of them. And I never got anything except one time in New Zealand in the Waitomo Hotel, off season, no guests. And we arrived, we were scouting for The Hobbit, and everybody got a room in a different wing. And I said, can you give me the haunted room? It was in a different wing. And they said, sure, here it is. Just drop the person guarding the hotel left us. Just put the keys on the box when you leave. And around midnight, I started hearing screams in the room. And I started hearing a man's voice sobbing in the room. And I put my earphones and I started to watch The Wire on my laptop because I was so scared. And I watched the whole third season of The Wire.
Just to try it.
I was just looking at the screen.
Right.
But what it is, I don't know. I don't have an explanation. Who has?
Yeah.
About what happens after? Does anything happen after?
Yeah.
You know, in the meantime, who cares? Let's just stay here and have a chat, have a coffee.
Yeah, I know.
Be good to each other.
Oh, yeah.
We'll
that's
be
all
okay.
I can do.
Yeah.
Okay. Why were you thinking about death since you were 7?
Because I was very scared. When I was a kid, my father won the lottery when I was about 6 years old. He won a massive amount of money. He won $6 million in 1969.
That is how, I mean, that's a lot of money.
That's
now.
A lot of money. To give you an example, on Sundays you had the $1 million movie on TV.
Yeah.
And he won six.
Holy moly.
He could have paid for the Planet of the Apes movie completely out of that win. That's how big it
wow.
was. So our life was upended. He became this noble. A noble gentleman.
He wasn't before.
No. He was middle. He had a car dealership,
yeah.
And he was doing okay.
Yeah.
But
he's elevated to a
all
new.
All of a sudden, yeah. Bam! Right, and he bought encyclopedias to have an office with books, and he bought them. I read them. I read the entire Encyclopedia of Art, the entire Encyclopedia Grolier, it was called, and one about health. It was an encyclopedia of health. And I learned every disease known to man at age 7. So every morning I would wake up and say, I have trichinosis, and I have multiple sclerosis. I have leprosy.
Yeah.
And Catholic religion in Mexico is full of a really compulsive dread and desire for death. It's a really, I mean, only Filipino Catholic religion is that obsessed with corruption of the flesh.
Yeah.
When you see a saint in Mexico made of plaster, is forensically right. So every Sunday, and then I became the official spokesperson of the Virgin Mary. I was like a little more than an altar boy. And we would go and rehearse speeches about the Virgin Mary in the catacombs of a Gothic cathedral in Mexico, which is completely insane. Somebody decided to make a Gothic cathedral called El Expiatorio in the middle of my hometown. And in the catacombs, there were the niches. And when the priest would leave, we would look into the niches and see. The only thing I remember seeing was the feet of a corpse, and the sole of one of the shoes had been corroded. So you could see all the tendons and the bones of the foot. And we ran away. But everything, salvation, death, childhood, Catholicism just became a bundle, a knot in my soul.
So how, does that lead to the storytelling? Like you chose?
Yeah.
To, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the great advantage of Catholic religion is great stories. Great stories. And told with a lot of verve and gore, yeah, and lurid details.
Yeah.
You know, there's violence, there's explosions of cities, there's God is like a super villain in a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
If you go to the Old Testament,
yeah,
God
but
is
he's
like,
vengeful in the Old Testament.
He's like,
yeah,
Thanos.
Yeah.
you get Avengers 6, you know? Oh, you know, the poor Job says, excuse me, sir, why? Shut up! You know nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have the proportions to talk to me. Yeah.
Or I made one mistake, a small mistake.
Yes.
Well, forever.
Thy shall be smite.
Yeah, forever. For all of eternity, because you messed up one thing.
And then my grandmother used to tell me stories that were absolutely dire of Saint Teresa or any childhood saint. In her obsession, she would say, and then this little boy saw how the missionaries were tortured and boiled, and I was like, thank you, Grandma. Anyway, all that is in Pinocchio. And every movie I've ever made, I mean, I tell you, the line between Cronos and Pinocchio is a straight line.
More of my conversation with Guillermo del Toro coming up. Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio is out on Netflix now.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
However the amount of chip on your shoulder you had, there's a thing that happens that is very physical, and it goes away. It goes away. It's almost like an imposition of the hands in a ritual. It goes away. Like, I cast you out, spirit.
I love an answer that's an honest and honestly non-humble answer to what happens when you win an Academy Award. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Oscar-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. In just a minute, you're going to hear, I sort of have this sort of like dinner party piece story about Guillermo del Toro that I run by him to see if he remembers it the same way I do. Guillermo's new version of Pinocchio is out now on Netflix. Just before we took a break, I was talking about what influences the stories he tells, what shapes his storytelling, and I wanted to talk more about that, to find out what drove Guillermo del Toro, one of the great storytellers of our time, to dedicate his life to telling stories at all. Here's more of my conversation with Guillermo del Toro. What I was trying to figure out there was the why of the storytelling at all. So that's what it is. Like you learn through Catholicism and through your
net movies. Obviously, yeah. My mom was a big cinephile, or rather, she liked going to movies really. And there are three things that more than come in. One is nannies telling you stories, uncensored. So there was a lot of ghosts and the devil, and there is a stone in my hometown that is covering a cave where the devil plays cards at night, and I was like, whoa. That's one. The second one is radio plays. I was born in 64, so when I was 5 or 6, we would everybody would get in the kitchen after TV ended around 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, TV ended, but radio continued. So we would listen to a radio play, The Mad Monk, and it would tell stories of horror, and we would be listening and dreaming. And the final component is Mexican syncretism. You know, Mexico was partially conquered because the friars decided to blend pagan mysticism with Catholic myth.
The friars who
came with the conquistadors.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, they decided the only way we're going to get these people to obey is if we make our Catholic myth palatable with fusing it with their mythology. Uh-huh. You know, so that's why the Virgin of Guadalupe is dark-skinned and is a mother that appears to Juan Diego. I mean, these are things that are constructed way.
So you see there that there's like tremendous power in just tales, in just storytelling.
Death and Life on Pinocchio look like Mexican carvings from 100% the cherubs, not the cherubs, the seraphims and the archangels in colonial paintings, they have eyes on their wings. This is from Judeo-Christian mythology, where they each of those eyes is going to close when a soul dies. And that's in Pinocchio. And Mesopotamian, which precedes Judeo-Christian mythology, the wings are also carved in a certain way. So all these things, the amount of things that influence a narrative is infinite.
So those things from your childhood are in this film.
And things from my adulthood. And, yeah. I mean, I think that there's a great fairy tale about three brothers that set on the road to marry a princess. And whoever the brother impresses the princess the most, who's really bored, will win her hand. And in comes this strapping young lad, and he's going to tell her about his adventures. And the second lad is also very brave. And the third lad is a quiet, pale kid that is gathering trash on the road. Oh, a dead bird, I'm going to put it in my pocket. A little bit of cord, I'm going to put it in my pocket. A stone. And when they come in, that the two strapping lads have very little to say. But this guy pulls out the dead bird, and the princess goes, what is that?
Yeah,
a dead bird. Why do you have it in your pocket? Well, I thought it was really beautiful. Look at the feathers. And he has a story to tell, you know. And I think that's the storyteller is the person that picks up useless little things along the road and has stories to tell about them.
And that's you.
That's 100% me, man.
What do you get out of it? What do you like about it? What does it give you?
I think what it gives everybody, if you can tell a story, and you are sort of organizing the universe in some way. That's why we did it. We were nomadic tribes, right? Going with each of the seasons.
Yeah.
And when we learned to use fire and we settled on a cave, what's the first thing we decided to do? Tell stories.
Yeah.
So we organize the universe through stories.
And through Pinocchio, we organize honesty. We organize obedience.
The disobedience being a virtue. The only truth you cannot destroy is telling the truth about who you are. That's the essential thing in life. Things like that. Life, the brevity of it. To me, all the things I can say about cosmically being there are all in the last line of the movie. What happens, happens. And then we're gone. And there's a humility to it, a surrendering to it. And I think that's the thing. I think the older you get, the more you surrender in a great way.
Before I let you go, last time I saw you, I don't know if you remember this, I was walking down this. It was one of the great thrills of my life was
I hadn't lived here very long, right? And I'm from like a little island in the middle of the North Atlantic, right? And I had talked to you before,
that's a great story already.
Yeah, I'm from
a little island in the North. Come on, come on, dude.
I'm from a little island in the middle of the North Atlantic.
How great is that?
I moved to the big city,
made of stone.
Yeah,
yes.
And I talked to you, and on the show about the Monsters exhibit, and then I think maybe a year after that, you win Best Picture at the Oscars.
Yeah.
And there I am walking down. I'm going to just start my storytelling now. Mm-hmm. There I am. I tell this story a lot.
In the city.
I'm walking down the street in the city with my headphones on, walking towards, at the end of a long day, walking towards the streetcar. And at the building where the Toronto Film Festival happens, there is the light box, they call it.
Yeah.
There is a secret, not a secret door, but there's a door that opens up out of a wall.
Oh, yes.
It doesn't look like a door.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, that door pops open, terrifying me. And who is standing there in front of me?
A large figure comes out.
You.
Hard to figure it out.
You are standing there, and you look at me, and I don't think either of us were expecting to see one another.
Yes, yes.
You had just won Best Picture.
Yes, yes.
I gave you a big hug, and I just said, like, hey, man, congratulations. And you were like, thank you, thank you. And then that was kind of all we could do, and it was very meaningful to me. That story was very meaningful to me.
I'm glad about that. Because I think that's life right there.
Yeah.
We just meet very briefly.
Yeah, yeah.
Say thank you, thank you. Yeah.
I moved on. Yeah, and I haven't seen you since.
Yeah.
Answer me this. Give me one thing that changes when you win Best Picture.
Well, there is, however, the amount of chip on your shoulder you had, and it can be big, you cannot quantify it. There's a thing that happens that is very physical, and it goes away. It goes away. It's almost like an imposition of the hands in a ritual. It goes away. Like, I cast you out, spirit.
Really?
And it happens like this. Your point of view is from the seats, and you're looking at the stage, like everybody at home. And all of a sudden, you get up, and you walk up the steps to the stage, and you turn around and you see the theater and everybody you have admired in your craft in some way or another is sitting there or standing, clapping, and something goes away. There's like a wave of, for someone like me, who has never quite belonged in one way of filmmaking or another because I'm worried about pop narratives and fantasy and fable, and I'm not quite a guy that fits in the commercial. I'm not handing out blockbusters every week. Someone, they're telling you, one of us, almost like a Todd Browning Freaks kind of way, and you feel a belonging for the first time in your life. Whether it's real or not, it doesn't matter. It just heals a little bit of that hairline fracture in your heart, and it doesn't come back. It stays healed.
It never came back.
And you can move on to other things.
Oh, my God, Guillermo.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was expecting with that answer, but that's beautiful.
But it's real. That's the thing. And you move on to other things, which is the nature of humanity. We go, okay, what do I worry now?
Yeah, and Pinocchio, life continues to happen.
Absolutely. And it's fine.
Congratulations on the film, man.
Thank you, man.
It's really beautiful.
This was a blast.
Lovely to talk to you, as always.
Same here.
I'll be honest with you. The answer I was expecting about what it's like when you win an Academy Award is like, oh, it's okay. You know, really, it's just, you know, it's nice, you know, but you know, it's okay. I love hearing an answer of like, yeah, it kind of fills a bit of a hole in your heart that you may have been missing. I just really loved it. Guillermo del Toro, the multiple Academy Award-winning film director, his latest film, Pinocchio, just took home the Oscar for Best Animated Film at this year's Academy Awards. You can watch it now on Netflix.
Hey, I'm Molly Tuttle, and you're listening to Q with Tom Power.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. We're going to talk a little bit about language. Take a listen to this.
We're at a very, very critical place, and I don't think a lot of people understand this with indigenous languages in this country. Our language is estimated to have less than 100 speakers. You know, even in my family alone, we lost 3 speakers, you know, last year. And so with those people passing, we're not losing words. We're losing entire ways of seeing the world. Mm-hmm. We come to know our world through our language, and we come to describe our world through our language.
I think that's important to keep in mind. We're not losing words. We're losing a way of looking at the world. That is the musician Jeremy Dutcher talking to me back in 2018. He had come into our studio to talk to me about this album that was about to come out. It was called Wallastawiglintawaganawa. And on the album, Jeremy enters into this sort of musical discourse with these archival recordings of elders from his community in the Tobik First Nation in New Brunswick. He is singing in their language, duetting with them. I mean, just take a listen to it. You're hearing the archival recordings and Jeremy's own voice duetting together. It's as beautiful as it is important and as deserving as it is of every accolade it received, because at the heart of Jeremy Dutcher's music, there is an urgency around the Wallastawiglin language. And what brought Jeremy into the studio last summer with his mom, Lisa Pearly Dutcher, was Lisa was starting an immersion school in New Brunswick for kids to learn Wallastawiglin. And Jeremy was raising money for the school with a series of concerts across the country. So I wanted to play this conversation for you again, because it's an interesting way of thinking about language. And Jeremy's doing this new thing now, where this new ballet based on a Wallastawiglin legend. So I thought it would be a good time to revisit this conversation. Keep that in mind. When we lose a language, we don't just lose words. We lose a way of looking at the world. Here's some of my conversation with Jeremy Dutcher and his mom, Lisa Pearly Dutcher. How are you?
Well, hello, Tom.
How's it going?
Very well.
Hi, Tom.
Nice to have you here.
Glad to be here.
You and I met, I think, when Jeremy won the Polaris Prize.
Yes, that's right.
You're a very proud mother out in the control room.
Try not to be, but, you know, yeah, it was a moment for sure.
Well, he's a hard fella to have as your son if you don't want to be proud, I suppose. Jeremy, how are you doing?
Very well. I mean, as you said, this is kind of a new venture for me, taking on education and thinking about language. And it's always kind of been a part of my work. But
yeah.
But now I'm really, you know, we've been working over this last year to build curriculum and solidify that space and building partnerships with the city. So, I'm feeling good because I feel like I'm directed in the work that I'm doing these days. Much like I was at the time when I was doing Wallastawiglintawaganawa, right? Like, I felt so directed and so, like, I knew what I was doing. We've been here since time immemorial, and we're still here, and we're still singing these old songs. And that felt like, and to put myself into it felt good. But it also felt scary, right? Because you weren't sure how that's going to be received by your intended audience. You know, I always say, like, and I never measured it by, you know, how many awards I get or how many people hear it or how many streams I get. It's always about who it's for. And it was for that community and they heard it.
Was it scary to play it that first time?
Yes. Oh my God.
Well, where was it? Where were you?
I think the first time I came home to share it was, we played this little venue called the Charlotte Street Art Center. And it was a DIY show. And we rented the space and cleared out brought in the chairs. And we just had people from the community, and it was not particularly well attended, but I knew it needed to start in the East, right?
Yeah.
Because that's where it's from,
yeah.
You know? And I was living in Toronto at the time, but there was always like, no, when we share it first, it's got to be in the East.
Yeah.
And they received it. And that just kind of like...
You were nervous.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about this new school. So you guys are working together on the new school, the Gagimin Wallastawiglin Language Immersion School. Lisa, tell me a little bit about how this came together.
Well, Jeremy's been really interested in the language, and it got me thinking about the importance of my language, especially since I lost three of my family members, and thinking, who's going to pass it on now? Like, it's up to me.
Oh, yeah.
So I really felt that urgency, and so I quit my job,
yeah.
And I decided to go into a language intensive program in Wallastawiglin because I'm what they call a silent speaker.
What does that mean?
That means like because I had gone to day schools and we were punished for speaking, I had a lot of anxiety with speaking. And so I kind of, when it just kind of got stunted. My language development was stunted. And so I didn't develop in my language. I was probably like a child of seven. And so I wanted to get over that hump. So I decided I was going to take this two-year program. And in the midst of that, I realized, and I had heard from various people talking about what it needed to happen in order for us to save our languages. We needed to have early immersion. But it didn't seem to be happening in our communities. And I was very puzzled by that. I thought, well, we know what the solution is, but nobody's doing it. And so I'm going to use the skills that I have to get this going. I might not be the one to carry it through, but I'll be the one that with a team, group of people to get it started.
That's so meaningful. I mean, and also so different than, what you would have gone through when you were a kid when it comes to what you're able to give to these kids, you know what I mean?
That's it. Like, I mean, to me, like I see my granddaughters now and think, you know, at least they will have a chance to pass it on to their children. Like I wasn't really, like, because I wasn't emotionally available to do that. I think that was, and now that I am, I can, you know, address that for myself. So again, it's a big part of healing for myself as well to do this work.
That's very, very exciting. Jeremy, you were saying, I think I cut you off there for a second.
No, no rush with this conversation, because I think this conversation does and is going to take a long time for folks to really understand the gravity of what's going on here. And I'm so glad that the words of healing have been spoken into this space already, because I think that is at the core, I think what's connecting, you know, my work and my mother's work, right? Because we're both taking maybe something painful or something that we don't have or something that we'd like to see and transmuting that into love and generative possibilities for people that aren't even us, you know, for everyone. And I think, you know, it's part of my mother's healing for sure. It's part of my healing as well, you know, to stretch towards fluency in our language. You know, Mom, you offered what you could. You offered everything you could when we were coming up, you know. So, yeah, there wasn't a sense of fluency in the home, but we did have words. And we had little, like, the thank yous and the I love yous and the, hey, could you pass me that? And, hey, you better behave and all that kind of stuff. That was still in our language at home, you know, even though. So stretching towards a fluidity and a fluency in my own language is it's lifetime work. You know, it's going to be a long time. But but it's something that I want to see for a lot of our young people.
When you say we've lost when you're in a situation where the language was almost extinct, when even around the house, you know, there was a couple of words you would hear every now and then. But even for you as an adult, fluency is something that's going to be a lifetime work for you. To know that there are going to be children, kindergarten to grade four, early immersion, we know that from science is how to make this thing happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, that must be so meaningful to you.
Well, it'll be nice to have somebody to speak to.
Yeah,
you know, when I'm an old man and we got all these kids that we raised up in this school and they'll have a chance to connect with their language. And really, that's what it's all about, right? Yeah. Connection. And I'm so happy that land-based is part of the education.
Can you talk about this? So some of the school is outside?
I mean, that's the kind of, and I'll let my mother maybe speak to this a little better, but definitely I think, I mean, our elders have been saying this since I was a little kid, but our languages aren't learned in a classroom. They come from the land and we learn them from the land, right?
Yeah.
Our languages, they only live here.
So what happens? Like, talk to me a little bit about this, Lisa. Like, what happens when you teach this language outdoors in the forest, in the woods?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about what is language anyway, it's a way of communicating, but it's also a way of communicating our worldview, how we see the world, how we interact in the world. And I think, to me, it is about bringing forth that worldview. And traditionally, our people were very much outdoors. So what we want to try to do is create a space where the majority of the time, unless the weather is so poor that we can't be out, we will be outdoors. And the children will be learning how to say, you know, trees, the different types of trees they're going to know. They're going to explore, and it's going to be very child-driven.
And I think what part is also really unique about this is an opportunity to learn directly from elders, right? Those language speakers are usually in the elder generation, right? And so for me personally, I know that those intergenerational mentorships and friendships have changed my life and put me on my path. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the more we can equip our young people, not to only have peer relationships, but also relationships across generations, that's when the truly, I think, generative, earth-changing work is going to come in. Because we've all got gifts. And in our wider society, we don't always listen to our elders.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think bringing back these philosophies through language, through land, through education, I think is how we're going to change the conversation.
And one of the things you're doing is you're doing a series of concerts, Jeremy. Take a drink of water, God's sake. Have a drink of water. I mean, he's been chatting away. You're doing a series of concerts to raise money for the school.
Well, I mean, it's under capitalism, it's kind of the magic sauce, no?
Yeah.
We got to have the money to do it. And I think for a long time, why we haven't seen a lot of movement is that governments are often dragging their feet around funding and often attaching their funding to say, well, you got to do it this way, you got to do it that way. What's unique about this project is we're kind of taking a crowdfunding methodology and trying to support it in that way, because I think when it's community driven, it's going to be most successful. And it kind of came home to me, you know, prior to the pandemic, we did a little tour on the East Coast, just like, you know, maybe five or six stops. And, my number one and number two fans, my mom and dad came out to each show. And we were just kind of starting around these conversations around the language school and, oh, wouldn't that be beautiful, dreaming, you know, and all this stuff. And anyway, so I just, in those shows, I took a little moment to talk to the audience, to try to engage our allies and our accomplices and say, you know, here's what's going on. Here's why I do what I do. Here's why I'm singing. You know, here's why I sing in my language. Here's where, like, what the situation is, the fact that we're in a really precarious place right now, you know, and what can we do? So I said, you know, go talk to, my parents are going to be in the lobby. They're going to stand behind a table. You go talk to them.
Hold on, Lisa, how did you feel about that being put out into the hall?
I don't mind. Like I said, it was for a good cause. And I was like, you know, I was honored that he was willing to do that and encourage people to have that those conversations with us.
And I mean, come on, you know, like, how did I come out to be like this? I have a very charming mother, you know? She just charmed him. And you know what? People came through.
Yeah.
And we made a lot of money just from little donations, just individual donations from people. And after that happened, I said, you know what? It's the time. It's the time for this work to happen and be lifted up, because our allies, they see it in a new way. And especially after this last year, we see it in a new way.
I'm not entirely sure how to ask this, but I'll ask it. When on the way in, when we were chatting a little bit in English when you guys came in, and then I think when you guys were trying to figure out where to sit, you guys switched to your language. I guess what happens in you when you speak your language to one another?
I think it creates a strong connection between, you know, people who come from that worldview. I mean, it's nice sometimes, especially when you want to say something and you don't want other people to know what you're saying. It's kind of like a secret code, right? It comes in handy, but it also, like I said, it gives you that deep connection to your family, to your community, and to the, like Jeremy was saying, to the land. I think that's really, because there's no place like you're going to learn Wolastoqway other than in our territory. Like, there's no other place in the world you can learn this language. So, I mean, we have a lot, like I was saying earlier, we have a lot of allies who are stepping up. Mm-hmm. And learning our language. Mm. Like, we have the mayor and some of her council and staff who are taking Wolastoqway language.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're really stepping up. And I've lived in Fredericton for over 35 years. Mm. And never in my wildest dreams did I think that, you know, this would be happening. It's just totally amazing. Yeah. And, you know, and then to know that we're going to start our first immersion school this fall is just another thing that just totally amazes me. Like, I just want to wake up sometimes and think, is this really happening?
Yeah.
You know?
So, yeah, it is.
It is, and it's happening because of you. because you made it happen.
Yeah.
And we got to celebrate that every single day because it is, it's amazing story what you're doing. And it's been an inspiration to me.
I love hearing the two of them. I mean, it's so rare to hear that sort of like to be. It makes you want to call your mom. It makes you want to call your mom and just and thank her for everything. That is the Polaris Prize-winning musician Jeremy Dutcher and his mother Lisa Pearlie Dutcher. Since we talked to them in June of last year, there's a couple of developments. The Kakimi and Wolastoqe Language Immersion School is up and running. There's also a new app that you can download to teach you the language. Just search for Kakimi Vocab Builder. I'll spell it for you. It's K-E-H-K-I-M-I-N. Jeremy has a new venture going on. I'm looking forward to talking to him about that. It's with the Atlantic Ballet Theater. He's written the music for a new ballet based on a Wolastoqe legend that's playing Moncton, Fredericton, St. John, Edmundston, and Miramichi in May. And that is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Tegan and Sarah will be here. There was a moment in the conversation where I felt compelled to ask, are you guys going to stay together? Because Tegan and Sarah have spent their entire lives together making music and now making a TV show based on their lives making music. What does that do to you as creative partners? And what does that do to you as sisters? They'll be here to talk about that. We'll see you then later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.